Our mission is to help individuals and organizations concerned with global issues make a difference in the world, so and using this technology specifically. Some people just need to use it really to help internal communications, whereas other people see it as a vehicle for mobilizing action, that they increasingly can use the internet to mobilize people to take action on human rights situations or, you know, to work on environmental issues. As more and more people get plugged in, it's a better and better vehicle for doing that.
Getting wired for peace on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Electronic mail, electronic conferencing, and the internet are changing the world. The Institute for Global Communications, based in San Francisco, describes itself as a nonprofit computer networking organization that links people and organizations around the globe who are working for peace, human rights, social justice, and environmental stability. Founded in 1986, IGC operates computer networks like PeaceNet, EcoNet, ConflictNet, and LaborNet. While these networks began as an American enterprise, Executive Director Jeff Sears describes how IGC joined with similar providers in other countries to link activists worldwide in the Association for Progressive Communications.
Starting in 1987, we happened to meet some people in England, an organization called GreenNet, and we kind of realized, no one had really been thinking that clearly about it before, but we realized that the same kind of thing we'd been doing with a U.S. focus could certainly have a lot of international applications, and maybe the greatest advantages of it were international. So after a lot of discussions, we decided to launch a kind of informal association, which wasn't even really named for quite a while. But in about 1989, it became more formally established at a meeting in Amsterdam, where seven different organizations, many of whom we'd helped get established, came together. And each of these was an independent organization, nonprofit in orientation, even though under some of the national laws of their countries they weren't formally nonprofits, but certainly in nonprofit in orientation and had similar goals as to ours of serving environmental and peace and human rights kinds of organizations. So APC got launched then in 89 with these seven groups, and those were, let's see if I can remember this right, PeaceNet and EcoNet in the United States, Web in Canada, GreenNet in England, Pegasus in Australia, Alternex in Brazil, Nicaragua. And it continued to function kind of on a very informal level for quite a while. And we hired a coordinator, probably was in 1990, we actually had the association itself had a staff person. It's continued really with just a single staff person up until now. We just held a meeting, and there were actually 26 different people represented at the meeting, and some hard decisions were made about going out and actually seeking some funding to build up the capabilities of the association itself. On a practical level, what the association is really a vehicle to help each of the independent members cooperate with each other and provide a global communication service. Through this association, we're able to help, an organization maybe based in the U.S. with whom we might have a direct contact, and if they need to get somebody connected to the net in former Yugoslavia or in Moscow or in different parts of Africa, through the association we can help them do that, that we have a partner in these different countries who can get somebody hooked up and provide them with the same kind of user support and training and services that we can in the U.S. Two significant advantages to that is, one, it's usually a lot less expensive to put someone on with a local system than making them make an international connection. And maybe even more importantly, with local user support and training, somebody can get the correct language support in Russian or support in Portuguese or whatever, and somebody who's on site to do the hand-holding. We find that particularly plugging nonprofits into this technology, people need a lot of hand-holding. Nonprofits aren't by nature very technology-oriented. And so having that local support makes a huge difference to helping people actually get something done.
Do you have anything that's close to a mission statement for IGC?
Well, our mission is to help individuals and organizations concerned with these kinds of global issues make a difference in the world. So, and using this technology specifically, how that might get put into practice depends a lot on what the organization needs to do. Some people just need to use it really to help internal communications, whereas other people see it as a vehicle for mobilizing action, that they increasingly can use the internet to mobilize people to take action on human rights situations. Or you know, to work on environmental issues, things of that sort. As more and more people get plugged in, it's a better and better vehicle for doing that. And it's certainly a lot cheaper to use for that purpose than, say, direct mail and some of the more traditional.
Yeah, I want to come back to that idea about being cheaper in a minute. Let's talk about this other aspect, this whole idea of the big UN conferences and the NGO forums that have sort of sprung up. And my experience with the NGO forums have been that they are unruly, sort of the people coming together, and you've had a presence there. Tell us about the IGC's presence at the NGO forums, both at Rio and Vienna, Rio the Earth Summit, in Vienna the Human Rights Summit, and then what's coming up for that.
Both at Rio and in Vienna, our goal was to be at the NGO forums and the UN conferences to offer communications and training to the non-governmental organizations that are there, as well as you know, any participants in the conference.
This is Sue Mooney. She's Women's Program Officer at the Institute for Global Communications.
This helps them get information back and forth to their offices or their home countries, and really allows people to participate or know about what is at the UN conference without actually being there. We also do a lot of on-site trainings to get people familiar with this technology and let them know how they can use it in their ongoing work for whatever their issue is, whether that's human rights or women's issues or environmental issues.
You put the conference documents somewhere where people can access them?
Yeah, what we do is set up a local area network and connect that in through whatever node is most applicable, and put as many of the official documents online. Then we also do like IPS feeds. There's usually a daily paper associated with these
IPS is the Interpress service?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we put those online. It's a lot of scanning and a lot of typing in by hand that information. But
the UN isn't providing this information to you in a computer-ready format?
Sometimes, but usually not, no. I mean, at this point, it's still a lot of scanning. Things like the IPS was on formatted disks, so that makes it a lot easier. But making these documents available would be much easier if it were on disk format.
I don't think the UN is naturally that oriented towards NGOs. Just showing by the way they've handled these UN conferences of being careful to place the NGOs usually at a site as far away as possible from the official sites. So they definitely have not been especially cooperative in providing documents.
And I think sometimes a misunderstanding of exactly what the telecommunications aspect is. I think a lot in Vienna it seemed that they felt that we are a word processing unit, which is not what we do. I mean, we like to offer that service in order for people to get what they need online, but it's more about information access and information flow.
Do you have any specific stories, anecdotes about anything that took place either at Rio or in Vienna about people who were able to use the services that you offered?
In Vienna, there are a lot of them. I think people are mostly excited about being able to fax the documents, the actual working documents, back to their office, having feedback from their office and exchanging that information. And then in Vienna, the Women's Tribunal, which was the NGO all-day forum about women's rights, human rights violations throughout the world, that was in an effort to lobby the governments to make women's rights human rights. We got that information online almost immediately. So, and we got a lot of feedback from people who are not at the conference who are really excited to have access to something like that.
You know, it strikes me that perhaps, I don't know if this is true or not, but at the Human Rights Conference at least, that ability that an NGO could go in and fax a working document back to their home office and then receive input is perhaps more than many of the official delegations had. I would imagine that a number of delegations from smaller countries may not have even had that ability unless they came down and used your service to get that kind of feedback from their foreign policy ministry back in their home country if they wanted it.
That certainly wouldn't surprise me. Although I think that the government delegations probably had more support directly from the UN, at least getting access to documents that I know at various stages during the Earth Summit, the UN ran out of printed copies of a lot of the key documents and weren't distributing them to anyone except, you know, the top levels of the delegation. So the kind of services that we ended up providing were really critically important because nobody could get hold of the documents except if they stopped by and we gave them a disc with all the documents on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, I mean, there really was no other vehicle for a lot of NGOs to even find out what was going on, except if they were able to plug in through their computers to get it.
Yeah. Wow, that is pretty interesting. One more thing before we leave this topic. On the upcoming Women's Conference in Beijing, that's 95, correct?
Right.
In 95. Now, it seems that in most of the computer magazines or things that cover the internet and other electronic communications, that there's always this talk about the fact that women are underrepresented in the population of people who are using these services. Does that provide a special concern as you prepare for the Women's Conference?
Yeah, that provides a big concern.
Yeah, and what can you do to increase their participation?
On the internet and on most bulletin board systems, the ratio of male to female is really uneven. We feel that what we need to do is more outreach and training to women, and that means contacting women's organizations that are involved in the planning and letting them know how they can use this to more efficiently organize, to get a hold of more information on women and the critical documents, and really demystify the UN process for a lot of women's organizations. One of the goals of our program is to train more women on how to use this technology efficiently, again, because it does better utilize your resources. It's cheaper than fax and phone calls, and a lot of the women's organizations are international and they're organizing around a topic. So we're doing, in leading up to Beijing, we're doing a lot of training and outreach to women and helping to get existing networks online. And I think that given a catalyst like Beijing or a real incentive to get online, I think more women will. But there's definitely that initial sense of, I don't want to do that. I don't want to learn all the new computer stuff. But then when they see what it can do, they're really intrigued and much more willing to learn.
Yeah, I was wondering which is harder to demystify, the communications technology or the UN process.
It's a tie.
Yeah.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Jeff Sears, Executive Director of the Institute for Global Communications, known as IGC, and Sue Mooney, Women's Program Officer, also at IGC. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available by calling Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
Jeff, let's go back to that issue of money and whether or not this is really a cheap and efficient and effective way for these organizations to communicate, or, you know, why can't they just use their stationery and envelopes and bulk mail?
Well, a lot of it depends on where you're located in the world. If you're in Nicaragua, you can certainly write a letter on stationery and send things out, but it may take 2 months for it to actually get delivered, whereas through the network, you can send your message and know that it will be delivered, usually, you know, within a few hours, if not a few minutes. So for many countries of the world, this has made a huge difference to organizations. They're just being able to communicate with their colleagues outside of the country, and in many cases, just even within the country. That we've had many stories of organizations in Russia, for example, using the network to communicate with their associates just down the street. So while some of these systems will get started and the main usage of them will be international communications, that gets kind of a catalyst to get it started. And once it gets going, people will discover all of the domestic and local applications it can be used for, and a lot of local traffic will be built up. But I think you were really asking maybe more about what are the possibilities, can this really replace direct mail and things like that, the traditional means for raising money and raising consciousness about issues. And that certainly is a big question right now. I don't think we've seen it make a dent in direct mail, but I think it will. The rate at which people are signing up for these things, I think there is a very real opportunity for organizations to use this stuff to really target very specifically people who are concerned about the issues and to get information to them in a format they may really enjoy more and may have a greater impact than direct mail does. The cost of doing it is I would say pretty much all an upfront cost that you have to figure out how to use the damn thing. But once you've figured that out, sending 50,000 pieces of email doesn't really have much additional cost beyond sending one piece of email, the way these things can be set up. Doing it correctly is kind of a social thing that we've seen examples on the internet recently of. There's a famous law firm who will remain nameless right now who got themselves into some amount of hot water by posting an advertisement to their services pretty much everywhere. It's kind of the equivalent of going and dumping a pile of leaflets on every single front yard in the entire country. And they got a lot of business out of this. There are certainly a lot of people who are interested in what they're doing, but there are millions of people who are very upset about what they did, and I think with good reason. And so organizations using it to appeal for fundraising or for other purposes have to be very careful in how they target people, how they structure their message and so on, so that they don't end up getting into a lot of trouble and causing more problems for themselves. So on the flip side, people who don't like you on the internet can do a lot to mess you up, from just completely filling your mailbox with junk mail and making it impossible for you to communicate, to more vicious things. This same law firm has been subject to quite a bit of attacks of people writing programs that automatically delete their messages and things of that sort. So there are a lot of issues to confront and kind of figure out how this whole electronic society works and what is proper behavior, what is the right etiquette for using it, and it's different from the right etiquette of using our older forms of communication.
And also the issue of who is participating in this electronic network, the demographics of who's on the internet is really, really different than a cross-section of our society. Again, back to there aren't as many women online, people of color, you know, inner city people, folks who
it's
don't
mostly
have...
mostly white men with an income of $50,000 or more,
Right. So as this medium replaces, you know, more traditional means of networking and consciousness raising, like direct mail, we have to pay attention to that and try to address those issues and get more people online who are not initially attracted to it, I guess.
Is that part of IGC's mission, I take it? I mean, that sounds like...
Yeah, definitely. We're extremely concerned with trying to plug a wider variety of people into this technology, and it's actually a constant struggle because the way a lot of the technology is going is towards much higher end
mm-hmm.
computers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we want to be able to present something that's an advanced kind of interface to the technology, something that's easy to use, but those kinds of things require a more expensive computer. And we're finding a situation now where there's actually a lot of very inexpensive older computers. Different companies and different
mm-hmm.
people are shedding
yeah.
their old stuff. And you can go out and pick up a perfectly workable computer now for on the order of $100 or less, and it makes the basic technology much more accessible to the average citizen's group or community organization or real voluntary organization. But on the other side, that technology is old, and it can't make use of a lot of the newer and more exciting features of the internet and the network that's out there. So it becomes a struggle for us of how to support these conflicting requirements that are out there, how to plug in really old stuff that the citizens groups are going to have access to, but still not dropping off the more advanced services.
Just give us a ballpark figure. If you're sort of the local citizen social justice organization and you want to be a part of PeaceNet or EcoNet or LaborNet or one of these things, how much does it cost? I mean, what?
Well, people spend on an average somewhere around $16 to $18 a month on the service. And some people who use it a lot can run up bills of significantly more. But if you're careful in your communications and do most of your work composing messages offline, you can easily do it for that, which is, you know, less than the average cable bill or people using cable television, things of that sort. And as I mentioned before, you can actually get hold of an older computer, a 286 or an original PC, something like that, for $100. We commonly see them for sale used at that kind of price. So it's increasingly possible to get into it, and that means that really the barrier groups are running into is how to make it work,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, is not trivial. You have to invest a good amount of time figuring out how to make this stuff function, which means that we're spending an increasing amount of time providing this sort of user support. Someone calls up and says, you know, PeaceNet's broken. That's all they know. All they know is PeaceNet's broken. And, you know, very seldom PeaceNet is actually broken. I mean, we run all the time, and it's usually a question of trying to figure out what exactly is wrong and trying not to make the person feel stupid in the process of trying to sort out what exactly is going wrong. But there are a lot of different pieces. From, you know, have to get your modem connected to the telephone line, and you have to get your modem connected to the computer and figure out how to make the communication software work. And there are lots of little bits and pieces that you shouldn't have to know, but you end up, you know, you do need to sort out at least the first time you do it. As the whole marketplace gets more competitive for providing just the basic online services, it's increasingly hard for us to provide that kind of in-depth support.
So in a scenario where you've got this local peace and justice group and they're interested in being a part of one of these, of PeaceNet or EcoNet or LaborNet or one of those things, like I said, is it the kind of thing where you see maybe one person in the group, whoever has maybe the title of secretary or maybe the president or something, sort of has the computer and has the connection and knows the password and is either adding information to the net about their organization or downloading information about, you know, that might be useful to their organization and then sharing it with their people? Is that the way it usually works or not?
You know, kind of the ideal scenario is when the executive director herself or himself signs on to this, because then there's some kind of institutional commitment to doing it. But unfortunately, that isn't usually the case. It's usually someone else in the organization, sometimes a volunteer or a board member, someone like that, who may not necessarily have all the equipment, but has an interest in making it work. They grasp the concept, and they're willing to figure out how to make it work and make it happen. Sometimes that's for a purpose of linking up their organization with other people. Sometimes it's for getting access to information. During the Gulf War, for example, we saw a lot of organizations come on just to get hold of information about what was happening in sort of anti-war activities across the country and worldwide, that at least in the media, mainstream media in the U.S., the perception was that everyone was behind the war, when actually there was, you know, a very large number of organizations and individuals, you know, highly opposed to the war that wasn't really covered. So a lot of people came on to the network to find out about who was, what was happening. And so we'd see organizations pulling down lists of events, lists of activities in different parts of the world, printing those out, photocopying them, leaving them at different cafes and other places like that. So we heard stories of people in Atlanta and Chicago and Sydney, Australia, and finding a printout marked PeaceNet on it in some, you know, coffee house somewhere. And so those things began to happen. The one big problem we run into, though, is that there's frequently lack of institutional support, that the use of the network will kind of pass from intern to intern to intern, and there's a constant retraining challenge of getting someone to figure out how to use this. It hasn't really reached the consciousness of much of the leadership. I think we really have a big educational challenge ahead of us to help the nonprofit community understand what this is good for. I was back in March at a big event in Washington, D.C. called the Public Interest Summit on the Information Infrastructure, which gathered around 600 people from nonprofits and the foundation community. And it was really stunning how few people had email addresses on the roster, that everyone was very concerned about how this technology will get used. But it wasn't apparent to me that any of them really have a grasp of what it is, even. And which I think is critical if we really are going to ensure that there is application for this stuff, that the public interest sector is still represented on the internet. I think all of these people have to get out there and really stake out a claim. Essentially, they have to get out there and start using it and start reserving some space and not just saying that it has to be done.
That is Jeff Sears, Executive Director of the Institute for Global Communications. Our other guest from the Institute has been Women's Program Officer Sue Mooney. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9439, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9439. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.